Hello, this is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atid and WebYeshiva.org with the first of a series of shiurim on the meaning and mechanics of Torah Shebaal Peh, in which we'll be principally looking at Maimonides' Hakdamah LePerush HaMishnah, his introduction to the commentary on the Mishnah, which outlines the history and workings of the oral law. If you are listening to the MP3 of this session, you are missing out on the fully interactive online experience, which you can try for yourself at www.webyeshiva.org. Okay, good evening and welcome to everyone. Let me just look through who's here with us online. I see a couple of new people, so welcome to you. I hope that those of you that are completely new to Web Yeshiva are finding it easy to use. If you have any trouble, Ezra Hurwitz is our online tech guy. Feel free to chat to him in the chat window. You can feel free to chat to me privately through the chat window if you have any questions, or you can chat publicly. Can everyone hear me? If you can hear me, hit the raise hand button on the, or send in a yes. Okay, great. Very good. We are looking at the Rambam's Hakdamah LePerush HaMishnah, or sometimes it's called the Hakdamah LePerush HaMishnayot. It's a work that's known by different names. We spoke about it a bit last semester, and I sent you all a link earlier today. If you didn't get it, email me. And I'll be glad to send it to you. I'll be glad to send it to you again. I'm just putting my email up in the chat box. I sent you a link to an MP3 of an introductory session about the Rambam's life and thought and his philosophy, which, if you were with us last semester, as many of you were, so you have that all down. You have that all down. By heart, still, and if you were not with us last semester and you'd like to review that, feel free to visit that link, and then we'll give you some background to the Rambam and who he was and what he was writing and why he was writing it and the larger trends in his Maimonidean thought. I'm going to skip all that this time because most of you were with us last semester, but again, it's there if you'd like it. But just very, very briefly, the first major work that the Rambam undertook, he started it when he was very young, and he completed it when he was 30, was a commentary on the Mishnah. A commentary Mishnah by Mishnah throughout every Mishnah in the Shas. There are a number of places in that commentary where he makes asides and he inserts lengthy essays that deal with a variety of essential topics in Jewish thought. Last semester, we looked at his introduction to Perek Chelek in Masechet Sanhedrin, which, among other things, deals with, puts forth his vision of the fundamental principles of faith, his views on the world to come and reward and punishment and the proper mode and method of reading and interpreting Agadah, among other important topics. By way of introduction to the entirety of the work, he wrote an introduction to the whole commentary on the Mishnah, which is an outline of the history and mechanics of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral law. As you all well know, we kind of conventionally divide the Torah between the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, which is the Tanakh, the Bible, generally in the wide, wide world is called the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, and the five books of Moses, the books of the prophets, and the assorted writings. That's the Torah Shebichtav. We'll talk more about that as we move along this evening. And the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, which was originally oral teaching, which begins the moment Moses starts receiving the Torah on Mount Sinai, and evolves and develops in different stages with different levels of authority, with different levels, with different areas of focus and interest historically. And the Rambam charts the history of the Torah Sheba'al Peh from the moment Moses goes up to the mountain until the Rambam. Mimoshe v'ad Moshe, as we conventionally say, and that is this work that we're looking at. We'll be using the Rambam's Hakdama l'Perush HaMishnah as our base, but we'll be taking, let's say, field trips off that base over the course of our series together to talk about different topics in what the Torah Sheba'al Peh is and how it works. When we talk about Torah Sheba'al Peh, very often we're talking almost synonymously with the Talmud, with what we even conventionally just call the Gemara. We'll talk a little more specifically about what that means and what all these different works are, but since the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, or what we just conventionally call Gemara, kind of looms as the largest figure on the playing field of Torah Sheba'al Peh, very often that's what we're talking about, and sometimes we're talking about other characteristics or other phenomena or other works in the Torah Sheba'al Peh. I'll try to be careful to differentiate, but sometimes it gets a little fuzzy. This text that we're looking at is a Ketav Yad. It's a manuscript edition of this work of the Rambam's Hakdama L'Perush HaMishnah. The Hakdama L'Perush HaMishnah. This is the Rambam's actual handwriting, apparently. The Rambam's Hakdama L'Perush HaMishnah, like everything he wrote except for the Mishnah Torah, was written in Judeo-Arabic. And was translated. It was translated in his lifetime. To Hebrew, and was translated a number of times since. The edition that we'll be looking at, because we will be studying it in Hebrew, is this, a very fine edition by Rav Shilat from Ma'alei Adumim. It was published here in Yerushalayim in 1997. Here's a copy of it. It's called the Hakdamot HaRambam LeMishnah. It's a collection. All of these standalone essays in the commentary to the Mishnah, Rav Shilat translated from scratch with introductions and notes, and it's a really very good edition. This essay that we're looking at, the introduction to the commentary on the Mishnah, has been translated a couple of times actually. Two translations that I just happened to find today available on Amazon, and I'm sure in Jewish bookstores, are these two different editions, neither of which was particularly cheap. I couldn't understand why, because it's not such a terribly large work, but this edition by Fred Rosner, who was a very fine writer and translator, called Maimonides' Introduction to His Commentary on the Mishnah. And this other edition, which I don't personally know, translated by Tzvi Lampel, Maimonides' Introduction to the Talmud. One is to the Talmud, one is to the Mishnah. It's the same book. It's the same book, just different titles in translation. So if somebody is interested in getting the work in English, here are two translations which are probably readily available to you. While we're just looking here, if you have a webcam, please turn it on. If you have your webcam, please turn it on. And if you don't have a webcam, get yourselves a webcam. Order yourself the cheapest webcam you can get from Radio Shack or from... do they even still have Radio Shacks, I wonder? Because I bet they don't sell radios. But I'm a little dated because it's been a while since I lived in America. From your local hardware store. Get yourself a cheap webcam or buy it online from Amazon or wherever and install it and use it for your Web Yeshiva experience, because it really enhances what's going on. So if you have a webcam, hit the send video button from the video panel. And I will just remind you that we have this feature also, I mentioned this the other night for those of you that are with us. There's this notes feature. In the panels on the side, there's a box called notes, which you can open up, and you can take notes as we're going along and save it. There's a button to save it. Saves it on your computer, wherever it is that you would want to save it. And I think that's the case. And wherever you want to save it. You can save it to your desktop, save it to a file, and then you have, it's your own private notebook. What you write there, as opposed to the chat box, what you write there is private, and only you see it. There are two, before we get into the Rambam's text, there are two little pieces of Gemara that I want to go over. They're very, very well-known Gemaras. They're very well-known Gemaras. Likely you know, you've heard them, or perhaps you've even read them on the inside, but they both are statements about the nature of Torah Sheba'al Peh, from different angles, saying different things about what this corpus is. But they're ideas that we should maybe keep in mind as we move along. The first is a well-known Gemara in Shabbat. It's well-known because it's, there are two reasons, I guess, that Gemaras become well-known or become famous, either because of what they say, or in this case, because it's right next to perhaps one of the top 10 most famous pieces of Gemara, if we, you know, could rank the Gemara by the greatest hits of the Gemara, if we could have, like, you know, Casey Kasem's top 10. That Gemara, the other Gemara, the neighbor Gemara, is the story of Hillel and Shammai and the convert who asks, teach me the entire Torah while standing on one foot. And Hillel famously says, Dalayach snei lechavercha lo tavid, what's hateful to you, don't do to somebody else. That's the entirety of the Torah. The rest is commentary, go and learn. That's a well-known Gemara. I'm guessing all of you have heard this if you haven't seen it on the inside. Well, right next door to that Gemara is this Gemara, which is a different story of, it's the Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Lamed Aleph, Omer Aleph. So it's a different story of a convert coming before Hillel and Shammai. Tanu Rabbanan, Maaseh b'nochri echad, Sheba lifnei Shammai. A certain non-Jew comes to Shammai. Shammai, who is known as being a little harsher, a little stricter. Amarlo, the non-Jew says, Kama Torot yesh lachem. How many Torot do you have? Amarlo, Shtayim. So he answered, we have two Torahs. Torah Shebichtav and Torah Sheba'al Peh. The written Torah and the oral Torah. Amar lo, Shebichtav ani ma'amincha. The written Torah, the Chumash, the Tanakh, that I believe. Sheba'al Peh, eini ma'amincha. But I do not believe in the oral Torah. I do not believe in the oral Torah. Now, I'll just add parenthetically here. Does this remind you of anything? Somebody who believes in just the written Torah and not the oral Torah? Does this draw anything to mind? Any historical? Right, so Raphael Yehoshaphat mentions the Sadducees and the Karaites. And the Karaites. There were different sects, different Jewish sects over the years. The Tzdukim, the Baitusim, and perhaps most famously the Karaim. The Karaim are post-Talmudic. The Karaites, who rejected the authority of Chazal, of the sages, of the Baalei HaMesorah, as they're called, the interpreters of the Torah. And they believed in a more, shall we say, independent or literal reading of the Torah, rejecting rabbinic tradition of interpretation. That's not necessarily what's going on here in the story. But as we'll go along and see with the Rambam, very much of what the Rambam is motivated by is an ongoing polemic with the Karaites. The Karaites from the same Shoresh. Here, let me just write the word up here. In Hebrew, they were called the Karaim because it's the same Shoresh as Mikra, right? Mikra meaning the scripture, the text. the text that we kra from the shorish of reading, right? Kore, right? The text that we read, the karaim, which were a group that began in the 10th century. I'm sorry if what I just typed just came out backwards. It seems okay on my screen. I'm not sure if it's... Okay, so then, you know, put a mirror up to it and figure it out back to left. You can get the point. Kuf, Resh, Aleph, Kro. So the Karaites, or the Karaim in Hebrew, were, you know, this most famous of sects that rejected the authority of the oral Torah and believed in a literal reading of the Tanakh. The Rambam, by the time the Rambam comes around, there was a pulmus, a debate between Rabbinic Judaism and the Karaites already for a couple of centuries. And part of the Rambam's agenda in setting out an argument for the integrity of the halachic system, for the rabbinic system, for the Torah Shabbat Peh, is part of this larger polemic with the Karaites. Somebody asked about the Neturei Karta. The Neturei Karta have nothing to do with this whatsoever. The Neturei Karta are a political group, a contemporary political group. The words Neturei Karta literally mean the Shomrei Habira, the defenders of the capital. Not the defenders. Sometimes you see it translated as defenders of the faith. That's inaccurate. It's the defenders of the capital, meaning of Jerusalem or of Israel writ large. That's a political group that fully accept the oral Torah. They're very, very pious Jews, except for one, what I believe, and I'm sure what many of you believe to be a mistake. They reject not the oral law, but they reject the significance of the modern state of Israel. But that has nothing to do with our conversation. Let's go back to our story here of the fellow who comes before Shammai. He says, I don't accept the oral law. And he asks, Geirani al menat shetilamdeni Torah shebichtav. Convert me on the condition that I'll study, that you'll teach me only the oral Torah, only the written Torah, only the Torah shebichtav, and not the Torah shebal peh. Ge'er bo v'hotzio ben zifa. So Shammai got agitated and he chased him out. Right? He said, this is illegitimate. We don't convert people that are only going to accept part of the Torah. The Torah Shebal Peh and the Torah Shebichtav are two parts of one holistic unit, and you can't have one without the other. Ba'lifnei Hillel, but when the same fellow came before Hillel, Gerel, he converted him. How could he convert him if he doesn't accept the Torah Shebal Peh? How could he convert him? Yoma Kama, the first day, Amar Le Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Right? He was a convert. He didn't know Hebrew. So he showed him, you know, you go to Hebrew school, you start studying Judaism, the first things you learn is the Aleph Bet. So he showed him, you see this symbol here? You see this symbol here? He told him, this is an Aleph. And he showed him, you see this symbol here? This is a Bet. And he showed him, you see this symbol here? This is a Gimel. And you see this? This is a Dalet. Right? It makes the D sound. And this makes the G sound. And this makes the B sound. Now why is this a Bet and this a Gimel? Because we all agree that this symbol is a Bet and this symbol is a Gimel. Now, it's true that there are Kabbalistic notions about the meaning of the shapes of the letters. And there's even a very interesting Gemara that makes drashot, that makes little homiletic lessons based upon the shapes of the letters. But the letters, as we have them, this alphabet is not the original Hebrew alphabet. When Moses came down from the mountain, these were not the shapes of the letters as he had them. And you know, apparently, the shapes of the letters are matters of... I mean, there are historical reasons for the development of all and every alphabet, that why one letter became one letter and a different letter became a different letter. And if you You know, look even in the Encyclopedia Judaica on the alphabet or whatever the article is, it'll tell you, like, it has that chart that shows the development of the what's the word for it? Not the graphology, you know, but the development of the letters, the development of writing. And that's true for every written language. But it's a matter of consensus. This is a bet, because we all agree that this symbol makes that sound. Because we have an interest in having consensus. We have an interest in having agreement. That's how we're able to use written language. So on the first day, this prospective convert comes and he teaches him Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Lo machar ipachre. But the next day he switched it around. And he taught him, he said, you see this symbol? This symbol is an Aleph. And this symbol is a Bet. And this symbol is a Resh. And this symbol is a Kuf. Right? This is, I mean, at least according to Rashi, this is how Rashi explains the Gemara. Maybe it just means that he, instead of Aleph and Bet, he said, this is the Aleph and this is the Bet. But whatever the point is, he changed it around. That's a very good association, Rafi. So Amarle, so the convert says to him, Vaha et mo lo amartali hachi. But that's not what you told me yesterday. So Amarlo, Lava lai didei kisemachta, d'al pe nami samuch alai. He makes a little joke, a little play on the words. When the convert says to him, but that's not what you said yesterday. Yesterday you said this was one thing, and now you're saying that this is. Yesterday this meant one thing, and today it means something else. So he says, no, you weren't only relying on me, you were relying on my mouth, meaning on my peh, meaning this letter, this symbol, this written icon only has meaning because it's part of an interpreted tradition that this symbol makes the da sound, and this symbol makes the ra sound, and this symbol makes the sh sound. Because there's an interpreted tradition of what these things are. And without that interpreted tradition, the tradition of interpretation, so the written text, the black on white written text, is meaningless. So he's pointing out to him. I mean, this is what Rashi explains, right? Rashi says, "Minayin ata yodei shezo aleph vezo bet, ela shelamadticha v'samachta alai." So he says, "How do you know that this is an aleph and this is a bet? How do you know that the meaning of this word means this and the meaning of that word means that? How do you know that this pasuk means this and that pasuk, that verse in the Torah means that?" He says, "Because I taught it to you, de alpe." That by my mouth, by my teaching, nami samuch al dvarai, you're dependent upon my interpretation of from student to teacher to student to teacher, going all the way back, in order to understand the black on white of what things are. So Hillel was trying to demonstrate to him, was trying to demonstrate to this fellow what the oral Torah is, and how the written Torah is insufficient. I mean, God forbid, don't take that sentence out of context and write a blog entry about what I said, right? But the written Torah itself is insufficient, because the written Torah itself, like all written documents, can only contain what it contains, black on white. And we need a tradition of interpretation to understand what that means. This is true for all written documents. If you have any interest at all, as I do, and I imagine I'll be making numerous comparisons, if you have any interest at all in the history of constitutional jurisprudence in the United States, it's been this 220 plus year experiment in how to interpret this written document. and how to give it meaning in contemporary society, at whatever point you're in contemporary society. Now, there's a tradition of interpretation, and there's machlokas about the proper way of interpreting the Constitution, which, you know, for people that are interested in that, find that very fascinating. Lahavdil, with the written Torah, we also have a much longer tradition of interpretation of what the written Torah means. And there's a mechanic for how that happens. And this is the point that Hillel is making to the Ger. The second Gemara, which is perhaps even more famous, and is definitely on the top 10 list, is this story of the Tanur Shelachnai. I'm guessing that this is familiar to everybody. You know what, do me a favor, either raise your hand or send in a chat if this Gemara is so familiar to you, you think that I don't even need to go over it. Okay, that's only 2 votes. 3 votes. Okay, so I'm going to go over it. I'll try to do it quickly. Here we go. Zehu Tanur Shelachnai. The Tanur Shelachnai, this is from the Rav Steinsaltz edition of the Gemara. It's a sketch of some archaeological guess. It's a type of stove. It's a type of oven, rather. It's a type of oven that you use to cook. The Gemara explains why it's called Achnai. It's kind of like a snake. It's made from different pieces that are kind of, you know, loosely joined together, and there's a machloket whether this type of oven can be mekabel tum'ah or is not susceptible to tum'ah, whether it can be rendered ritually impure or it's not susceptible to that type of defilement. It's, for our purposes, it's not essential to know the intricacies of that law, although there's probably a reason that this Gemara is connected to this particular halakha, but we're not going to go into that tonight. But there's a machloket, whether or not this type of vessel can become ritually impure or is invulnerable to becoming impure. So Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, v'timehu, right? It can become tame, can become ritually impure. Tana, be'oto hayom heshiv Rabbi Eliezer kol tshuvot shebaolam v'lo kiblu imen. That's, for those of us that learned Masechet Brachot together a while back, I hope you'll remember what this is referring to. So, amar lahem, im halacha kemoti, Rabbi Eliezer said, Rabbi Eliezer believed that the Tanur Shel Achnai could become impure. But there was a machloket. There was a machloket about this matter. So he says, if the halacha is like me, charuv ze yochiach. He was arguing. Everybody disagreed with him. All of the chachamim were there. They were gathered around, and they were taking a vote, because that's the way halachic decisions were made at that period. So he was sure he was right, even though he was in the minority opinion. And he says, if I'm right, you see this carob tree? A miracle will happen. It'll prove my point. Ne'akar charuv mimkomo mea ama. V'omri la arba me'ot ama. So the carob tree jumps up. It gets uprooted. It gets jumped. And it jumps away either 100 amot, 100 cubits, 100 yards, or 400 yards. Amru lo, the other sages said to him, ein mefi'in raya min acharuv. We don't bring magical proofs from a carob tree. Chazar va'amar lehem im halacha kemoti, amat hamayim yochichu. He says, you see this stream? That will prove that I'm correct. And a miracle occurs. Chazru amat hamayim lachureyim. The stream starts flowing backwards. Amru lo ein mevin raya be'amat hamayim. He says, we don't, that doesn't prove anything. That's not how halacha is determined. You can bring a miraculous proof. That's not a source for anything. Chazar v'amar lahem im halacha kimoti. He says, if the halacha agrees with me, if I'm correct, kotlei beit hamadrash yochichu, the walls of our house of study will prove it. Hatu kotlei beit hamadrash lipol, the walls incline, they start to cave in. Ge'ar v'hem Rabbi Yehoshua, amar lahem Rabbi Yehoshua shouts out at the walls, Im talmidei chachamim menatzchim ze beze b'halacha, atem mativchem. He says, if the scholars, if the sages should destroy each other in debating a matter of halacha, so what good are you, walls of the Beit Midrash? Lo naflu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Yehoshua. So out of deference to Rabbi Yehoshua, the walls don't cave in. But neither did they go back up straight. Velo zakfu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Eliezer. Va'adayin matin va'omdin, the Gemara says. The walls of that Beit Midrash, wherever they are, they're still standing askew like the Leaning Tower of Pisa as a memorial to this epic battle between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. This was not the first time Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua met on the playing field, on the battlefield of halachic debate. Chazar v'amar lahem, Sir Rabbi Eliezer says, Im halacha kamoti, min hashamayim yochichu. The heavens themselves will prove that I'm correct. Yotzta bat kol v'amra, a heavenly voice shouts out, Malachem etzel Rabbi Eliezer, what's with you guys? Shehalacha kemoto b'chol makom. The halacha is in accord with the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. So Amar Rabbi Yehoshua al raglav, Amar Rabbi Yehoshua stands up and shouts up to the heaven, Lo bashamayim hi. It is not in heaven. The halacha is not determined by miracles. The halacha is not determined by heavenly voices. The halacha is not in heaven. The halacha, the Torah, was in heaven, and it was given to the Jewish people. My lo bashamayim hi. What does it mean the Torah is not in heaven? Omer Rabbi Yirmiya shekvar netna Torah mehar Sinai. The Torah is no longer in heaven because it was already given over to the Jewish people. And that misirah, that handing over of the Torah, it wasn't just that God said to Moses, you see this book? You see this book? Here it is. With the book, he kind of gave the keys, as it were. He gave the instruction manual. And he passed over, as it were, the authority for the interpretation and application of the principles contained in the Chumash to Moshe and to all of the duly ordained authorities that would come in his wake and who would be heirs to the tradition of Moshe Rabbeinu, to interpret and apply the Torah. That's what happens. And therefore it's no longer in heaven. It's here invested in the human, in amongst the scholars and the Talmidei Chachamim and the sages who are entrusted to make interpretive decisions of and about and by the Torah. Ein anu mashkichin bevat kol, says Rabbi Yehoshua. We don't pay attention to heavenly voices in matters of interpreting the halacha. Shekvar katafta b'har Sinai b'Torah acharei rabim lahatot. In the Torah itself, the Torah in Shmot, Perek Kaf Gimel, the Torah says that the Beit Din, that the earthly court is entitled to make decisions and to render judgments based upon majority rule. Acharei harabim lahatot. to follow the majority. It's better to have unanimity, but if we can't reach unanimity, if there's a matter of machloket, the Rambam will describe very shortly, if not tonight, then in our next session, what's the deal with this machloket? How could it be that there are people that we don't know what the halacha is, that there's disagreement? Where does that come from? And how do we resolve it? Then the Gemara has this felicitous conclusion, Eshkecher Rabbi Natan le'Eliyahu, like a kind of miraculous behind-the-scenes description of what happened. Rabbi Natan bumps into Eliyahu Hanavi. Eliyahu Hanavi, you know, the kind of the character in Agadah who's ever, you know, omnipresent and can, you know, transcend history and kind of be both up in heaven and down on earth. So he says to him, "My avid kucha brichu b'ha'hu shata." What was God doing at that moment when Rabbi Yehoshua stands up on his feet and basically, pardon the expression, I mean, I'm putting words in Rabbi Yehoshua's mouth. He didn't say this, but basically he tells God to shut up. He tells him to mind his own business. Right? In other words, the heavenly voice shouts out the halachas like Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, "Pardon me, God, you don't have a vote." So Omar Le, my avid kucha brichu b'ha'hu shata. What did God do at that moment? So Omar Le, kachayech v'amar nitzchuni banai, nitzchuni banai. He smiled, as it were. I mean, the whole story obviously has to be, this plays back to what we were talking in the last semester about the metaphorical interpretation of Agadot. But, you know, as it were, God sat there smiling, saying, Nitzchuni banai, nitzchuni banai. My children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. Meaning, I raised the Jewish people to be the bearers of the tradition, to be the authorized interpreters of the Torah, and they're going to interpret the Torah even if in heaven, I myself, God says, I would have determined the halacha differently, but yet they're entrusted to make those decisions. And when they make those decisions, they're entitled to make those decisions, and as it were, I got outvoted. Rabbi Soloveitchik famously homilized the Gemara to say that it's not nitzchuni banai, that my children defeated me, but from the shorosh of netzach, which means eternity, where he says that my children have not defeated me, but they've eternalized me. Because by continuing the interpretive tradition, by continuing to be involved in the interpretation of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, they make the Torah eternal. This is the famous Gemara of the Tanur Shel Achnai. I think the two Gemaras together say something about what the nature of Torah Sheba'al Peh is. I apologize that I spent so much time going through this piece of Gemara, because I'm sure it is very familiar to many of you, but it's always worthy of review. But it's an essential statement of our belief in what the Talmud is, what the Torah Sheba'al Peh is. That we become entrusted. By we, I don't necessarily mean you and me. But we, the Jewish people, as a collective, and through the spiritual, intellectual, religious leadership, really in every generation, although we'll see that there were certain generations that had larger shoulders and more authority than others, that the Jewish people, through the spiritual, intellectual, rabbinic leadership, become the bearers of the interpretation of the Torah in each and every generation, and that it's a democratic process. There's this kind of notion that the halakha, that the rabbis, that the Torah, it's not democratic. That's really not true, although it may look like a different form of democracy than what we commonly think, or our common associations with that term. But it's a Torah which is meant to be kept alive through the ongoing interpretation. I'm going to turn now to the Rambam's text itself, and we'll just try to briefly get into that tonight. Before I do, are there any questions on what we've discussed up until now? Feel free to chat, or again, I encourage you all to feel free to speak up. If you have a microphone, not everybody has a microphone, a live microphone. If you have a microphone, feel free to speak up. Or if not, hit the raise hand button, and I'll be happy to pass you the microphone. I think it's good that, you know, we invest such a fortune of money in this technology that people should use it for more interactive uses. Any questions or comments or thoughts up until now? Can you repeat the resident is going on? So I'll just quickly, in other words, the Gemara probably literally means at the end, what was God doing? What was God doing at the moment that Rabbi Yoshua stands up and basically tells him, mind your own business? Eliyahu Hanavi says, Ki chayech v'omar, kachayech v'omar nitzchuni banai. Right? He smiled and said, my children have defeated me. Right? That's probably what it literally means. But Rabbi Soloveitchik, metaphorically or homiletically, said it means that he smiled and said, they eternalized me. Now, the shoresh of Nitzchuni can also mean eternal, like Netzach Yisrael. Right? So in other words, that God becomes eternal through the Jewish people's continuing application of the principles by which... It's like Lahavdil. I mean, somebody pointed in the chat, who was it? Ben and Barb Boselski put that in the chat, that it's a parenting lesson. So those of us with children know that this is true, that, you know, our aspirations for our children, our aspirations, it's like eternal. Right? There's that Woody Allen joke. I think Woody Allen at some place says, you know, most people want to become immortal. Most people think that they, what is it? The people want to be immortal through their children. You think you'll live forever, you know, through your children. So Woody Allen said, I'd like to be immortal by not dying. but that's, I think, unlike Woody Allen, I think the point here is that by continuing God's, Sherry says, by continuing God's precedent, by being involved in the system that he passed over to us. I mean, like, I'm sure many of you have had this experience. I know that I did. I had it very quickly. Other people, it takes longer. You teach your kid to play chess. I taught my son to play chess when he was, you know, rather young. And in order to teach him, I had to beat him. There's no way you can initially just teach, you know, the movement of the movement of the pieces and the rules of the game, but you have to then actually start playing the game. And there's no way that you're going to lose the first time you play. There's no way you're going to lose the first 10 or 12 times you're going to play. But ultimately, if he's any good, he's going to beat you. You're going to lose the game. And, you know, most people don't like to lose. But that's usually a very pleasurable experience, the first time your child beats you at a game of chess. Because you've taught him the rules, he's internalized it. I see Sherry Levin, I see your... I see your comments. No, it's not internalize, it's eternalize, but let's make that play on words here. Right? In other words, it doesn't work in Hebrew. The word in Hebrew means either defeat or eternal, meaning to live forever. But let's make your play on words here. Internalize, lahafnim, right? That's the fact that your kid can beat you at a game of chess or at a game of tennis or, you know, choose whatever competition you want. Is usually something very pleasurable to the parents because it's a sign that they've learned the lesson, they've learned the message. So I think that's the metaphor. I think that's the metaphor here. The Rambam here at the beginning of the Hakdama le Mishnah, I think I mentioned last time, these, you see this Aleph here, that this is kind of section Aleph or chapter 1. These are put in by the editor of this volume just to break the text up into conceptual nuggets, as it were. But in the original text of the Rambam, it's one long essay without without chapter breaks. And depending upon the edition of the essay that you're using, either in English or in Hebrew, the division into chapters may differ. But this is sectional. Well, I mean, every edition is going to start off being chapter one, but it's going to break up differently as you go along. So the Rambam says, he has this kind of notion which may be familiar to you. The notion may be familiar to you from Pirkei Avot. The Rambam starts off by saying, Da, he kol mitzvah shenatan Hashem l'Moshe Rabbeinu. Every mitzvah that God gave to Moshe Rabbeinu, nitnalo im perusha, was given to Moshe with an explanation, with a commentary. Now let's be clear on one thing. It might not have been the way you saw it in the movie, either the movie or the cartoon. The Jewish people leave Mitzrayim on Pesach. 7 days later, they're standing with their back against the Yam Suf, the sea. There's a miracle, the sea splits, the Jewish people move through. They wander into the desert at Mara. It's a place. If you Google it, you'll find a map. There are a couple of mitzvot that are given immediately to the Jewish people, including Shabbat. Including Shabbat. The mitzvah of Shabbat is given right away. On the 40th day, I'm sorry, 7 weeks after leaving Mitzrayim, on the 49th day, they're already at Har Sinai. We're not exactly sure where Har Sinai is. But it's somewhere there in a desert. And Moses receives the Torah from Hashem. What does he receive? So, sometimes we think it means he received this whole book. So that's probably not what happened. He received the Shnei Luchot HaBrit, the Ten Commandments, and he received during those 40 days that he's up on the mountain, he receives the beginnings of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Essentially, he starts learning the system for what God's plan is, and this written text, the first layer of which is, let's say, the Ten Commandments, he begins to receive the perush, the interpretation. And not just the interpretation, but the tools by which he can then make applications. And then the rest of the Torah is given as they move along throughout the 40 years. This is the opinion in the Gemara that Torah Megillah Megillah Nitna, that the entirety of what we call the Torah, what we call the Chumash, was revealed piece by piece over the course of the 40 years, and that the entirety of the Torah, the whole collection of all the five books, was really only put together towards the end of the 40 years of wandering in the desert. But the Rambam's essential point here is that Kol HaTorah, Kol Mitzvah Shenatan Hashem LeMoshe Rabbeinu, Nitna Lo in Perusha. Everything that was there in the written text was given with explanation. Essentially, Moshe is a secretary. He's taking dictation. God says, write this down. Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz. And Moshe writes down, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz. And then God explains as they move along what each thing means. Haya Hashem omer lo hamikra. God would dictate to him the text. V'chakach omer lo perusho v'inyano. Uma shekolel ze hamikra hamechukam. And he would then, after dictating the text, he would explain what it means. He would explain in the halachic sections. We'll see an example shortly. But We'll see an example shortly. But in the halachic sections, like for example, here's an example. It's not the example the Rambam is about to give, but it's a very, it's a good example, and it's one we'll return to. There's a pasuk. I hope you know it because we say it all the time. V'hayu l'totafot bein einecha. That you should put totafot between your eyes. This is an example of a written text which is utterly meaningless. I mean, it's strange to come to a Torah class and hear the rabbi say that the Torah is meaningless, but the text, if you land from Mars and don't know anything about God, and don't know anything about the Jewish people, and don't know anything about the B'nai Yisrael, or Torah Yisrael, or Eretz Yisrael, you don't know anything. You land from Mars, it's been a long trip, you check into a motel, because you're tired, and you take the Bible out of the night table stand, and you just start reading. So you're going to get to a pasuk, and the pasuk is going to say, put totafot between your eyes. There's no way to understand what that means absent a tradition of interpretation. If you look at the Ramban, if you look at even at Rashi, we don't even know what the word totafot means. So the Rambam is telling us that Hashem gave an explanation. To tell you this means there are these little boxes. They're what we call tefillin, and in the tefillin there are four sections of text from the Torah itself. And these are the four sections of the text. And this is how they're made. And they have to be square. They have to be perfectly square. And they have to be black. And they have these leather. They have these leather straps, etc., etc., etc. Bein einecha doesn't mean right here, you know, at the bridge of your nose. Bein einecha means up here, actually, on your hairline, or those of you that still have a hairline, or those of us that don't, where the hairline used to be. That's the interpretive tradition, and that's the kind of commentary that Hashem gave to Moshe. What kind of commentary? The Rambam will later describe that this is what's called the Halakha L'Moshe Misinai. That with the written text came the oral instruction manual. V'hayat to'ar limudol Yisrael kimoshe asapelecha. And then after Moshe got the mitzvah, he would teach it to the Jewish people. And the rest of this paragraph describes the pedagogy that took place in the Midbar. We'll just do it very briefly. Haya bola ohalo. He would return to his tent. Here, Saul asks about Yahushua, so here he is. Keep your pants on, Saul. Nichnase lav tchila Aharon, his brother, Aharon HaKohen, would then come. V'haya kore lo ha-mikra ha-natun lo pam achat. He would teach, whatever the teaching was, he would teach it to Aharon one time. U'malamdo perusho. He would teach him the written and the oral. He would say, God told me the following. God told me, Basukot teshvu shivat yamim. Sit in Sukkot for 7 days. But what's a sukkah, and what is sitting, and how does it work, and what's the mitzvah? So he would teach him both. Achar kach mistalek Aaron. Then Aaron would leave. V'chozer liyamin Moshe Rabbeinu. He would leave the teaching. He would leave the learner's position and move to Moshe's right hand. Nichnasim acharechein Elazar v'Itamar banav. The children of Aaron, the Kore Moshe Gam Lehem, Kemoshe Kara LaAaron, V'Chakach Mistalkim Shnehem, V'Chozer Echad Mehem L'Smol Moshe Rabbeinu, V'Asheni Le'amin Aaron. Right, and they would like leave that position, and they would take their spot. They would leave the learner's position, and they would take their spot on our side of the desk, as it were, one to Aaron's right and one to Moshe's left. V'Nichnasim. Acharechen shivim zkenim. Then the 70 elders, the proto-Sanhedrin, as it were, enter. ומלמדים משה גם כן כמו שלימד אהרון ובניו. ונכנסים אחרי כן המון עם. And then the masses would come. כל מבקשי השם. Anyone who would want to learn. וקורא גם להם. Right? עד שישמעו הכל ממנו. Until everybody heard it from Moshe himself. So that it wasn't a case that you know, Moshe was getting the Torah, and there were other peoples, and there were levels of intermediate. Everybody had access to Moshe. Well, the first Aaron, and then Aaron's children, and then the 70 elders. Aaron, Aaron's children, 70 elders, and then the entirety of the people, or at least those that were interested. Right? So that Moshe has now taught it four times. Right? Nimtza Aaron shomea ha-mikra ze arba pa'amim mi-Moshe. Aaron hears it taught four times, once to him, once to Aaron's sons, once to the 70 elders, and once to the entire people. And Aaron's children hear it three times, once to them, once to the 70 elders, and once to the entirety of the Jewish people. So everybody hears it at least once, and some people, Aaron heard it at least four times. Moshe then leaves, and Aaron now teaches it. Asher shamu mi Moshe arba pa'amim, ki Moshe sipar nu l'chol ha-nimtza'im, mistalek Aaron gam ken, v'nimtzu shnei abanim shomim oto arba pa'amim. So that Aaron's sons hear it four times, three from Moshe, and once from Aaron himself. V'chozrim gam elazari tamachar, etc., 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 so that everybody hears it four times. But depending upon where you are in the ladder, you hear it either from Moshe four times, or you hear it once from Moshe and three times from Aaron, etc., etc., etc. You can figure that all out. You can do the math for yourself. Nimtzu ha'am shomim et ha-mikra arba pa'amim gam ken. So that the whole people would hear each lesson, each pasuk as it's given, and each interpretation of the pasuk four times. Once from Moshe, twice, the second time from Aaron, the third time from Aaron's children, and the fourth time from the 70 elders. Where's Yehoshua? Saul wants to know. Yafet. He's there in the shadows. That's at least one interpretation. That's at least one interpretation of what does it mean that Yehoshua inherits the mantle of Moshe, because he was there serving the drinks. And he absorbed the whole thing. Okay. We're gonna, and those people have to run to the next class. But we'll pick up here next time. This whole first section is available. You can download it from our webpage if you want to read ahead. And again, if anybody has any questions, feel free to email me or Gmail chat me in the intervening week. Shabbat Shalom. Awesome.